After the victories at Gettysburg and Vicksburg, the crowd came to the White House. They wanted a speech from Lincoln. He didn't like extemporaneous speeches, but he began his speech by saying, "What was it 80-some-odd years ago that our..." But 4 months later, 47 years ago, our forefathers... He had that sense of the rhyme, the cadence from the King James Bible. Give Lincoln time, and he could fashion words that we are still repeating today.
Welcome to Book Tour. I'm Lynn Neary. Abraham Lincoln didn't keep a diary. His wife Mary burned all their correspondence. But he did make a habit of jotting down notes and saving them at odd places, like his top hat. In these notes, Ronald C. White Jr. finds a new view of Lincoln. In these scraps, White says, Lincoln would test out ideas and puzzle through problems, and some of these private thoughts would find their way into the eloquent speeches that have so defined our idea about President Lincoln. White has written two earlier books on the rhetoric of Lincoln, but his new book, A Lincoln, is a biography, the story of a life. As White told one interviewer, he set out to portray Lincoln in all his humanity. White discussed his new book, A Lincoln, at the Politics and Prose bookstore on February 6, 2009.
I want to begin with a question. I know I'm here in Washington, where perhaps the Lincoln Memorial is old hat. It's never old hat to me. But I want you to get back in touch with perhaps the first time you ever visited the Lincoln Memorial. You may have been a child, a young person on a school trip. I love to visit it at night. Every time I come, I want to visit the Lincoln Memorial. I talk to people in other parts of the country for whom this is quite an expedition to come here on the West Coast, for example. You recall how as you walk up those steps, you see first that tall Daniel Chester French statue. It will be rededicated by the Abraham Lincoln Bicentennial Commission on Memorial Day. In that, what I call, templed space on the left is the Gettysburg Address, carved in one panel. If you turn to the right, carved on three panels in Indiana limestone, is the second inaugural address. Would a few of you just be willing to say, what was your experience, your feeling, the first time you were there? Or maybe the last time you were there. Anybody? I'll repeat what you say.
Awesome.
Awesome.
Went there when Marian Anderson.
Oh my goodness sakes alive. Did you hear this? She first went there when Marian Anderson sang there. Was that 1932? 39. Pardon me. 39. Oh my goodness. And someone else out here said
moving.
Well, let me take those words, awesome, moving. The point of what I'm trying to do in my biography is to suggest that however deep the feeling might be, and I've heard other words, reverence, sacred, some people answer the question with tears in their eyes, that is not the same thing as understanding. As a student at UCLA, I sang in the a cappella choir with Roger Wagner, the founder of the Roger Wagner Chorale. In our junior year, we sang St. John's Passion, and it was a moving, awesome experience. He told us right afterwards, our senior year, we'd sing Beethoven's Missa Solemnis. But I realized I didn't understand that music, even though I enjoyed it. So the next year, I took non-music major appreciation courses in Bach and Beethoven. I'm writing, in a sense, for almost the non-Lincoln person. A biography of Abraham Lincoln that will go beyond the awesome, reverent feeling to try to get into an understanding of who this person is. My real goal was to try to get at the moral core of the man. What is it that distinguishes his character, his integrity, or kind of the more modern word, the authenticity about him? In the introduction, it was suggested that there is, and this surprises people, it's not simply Lincoln's scholarship that is advanced, it's the finding of Lincoln materials. About 20 years ago, a professor in Illinois got together a team of master's students and said, let's go out to the 99 or 102 county courthouses in Illinois. I wonder if there's still Lincoln legal papers lying around somewhere. They found hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Lincoln legal documents rolled up, mostly turned blue, and people over 100 years ago had razor-bladed out every single time Lincoln's name appeared with A. Lincoln, the title of my biography. But Lincoln's handwriting is so distinctive, it was obviously Abraham Lincoln. So my biography incorporates more than perhaps heretofore. David Donald had some of this material, but it wasn't all put together when he wrote his biography of Lincoln the Lawyer. Now, I have to say that sometimes my editor, the marvelous novelist David Ebersoff, would come back to me and say, Ron, this isn't very sexy. But still, the story of Lincoln the Lawyer, well, what did we learn? That Lincoln the Lawyer is not simply a prosecutor, but he saw his role primarily as a peacemaker, his word, or a mediator. He would say to people, settle if you can. You're going to live in these small communities after the judge or jury renders the verdict. Settle if you can. He said to the bully on the block, the Illinois Central Railroad, don't sue these people. You may win the suit because you've got this corporate muscle, but you have to live with these people in Illinois. Just a couple of other examples. You may have read some of these. About 3-4 years ago, a man in Longmont, Colorado, accessed the National Archives to look at a photograph of the first inauguration of Ulysses S. Grant. And when he looked at the photograph, he said, this isn't the inauguration of Ulysses S. Grant. Look at all those soldiers. So he contacted the National Archives and said, I think you've mislabeled this photograph. This is obviously Lincoln's second inaugural. And they said, oops, you're right. That's true. And I could go on and on and on with stories of a woman walking into the Abraham Lincoln bookshop in Chicago 5 years ago and saying, this letter, my great-great-grandfather was a Republican congressman. I believe this is a letter from Abraham Lincoln given to him. We've had it in our family all these generations. Most often, these letters that are brought in to the Huntington or the Library of Congress are not authentic. This was. And in October of 1859, Lincoln said in this letter to the congressman, whomever will be our candidate for the Republican nomination for president next year must take a strong anti-slavery stance. If Lincoln wasn't thinking of himself, if that person does not do so, it would be idiocy. That's not a kind of word that Lincoln usually used, idiocy. It already moves back what Lincoln was saying and thinking about anti-slavery and the issue of slavery. I've given you a handout for tonight. It's my attempt to put in your hands, as you came in and sat and perhaps had a moment or two to read these and to take it home with you, some of the key words of Lincoln that define himself. If you think about it, all of us, in a certain sense, define ourselves by the words we use. Lincoln, most especially, not only did he define himself, but increasingly he began to define, and I would argue, redefine the meaning of America. The first vision, the largest vision of Lincoln, is as the politician. And we have been through a campaign recently in which, consciously or unconsciously, I think we have been weighing the candidates. We all know that they have quite an ego to be able to run for high political office. We're not necessarily put off by their self-confidence or ambition, but we're looking for something else. I was so struck on November 4 in President Obama's speech at the incredible humility of that speech. He pointed beyond himself in the most amazing way. It was just thrilling to listen to that speech because most political speeches are I. Do you know that in Lincoln's Gettysburg Address he used not one personal pronoun? I say Lincoln disappeared in the Gettysburg Address and the second inaugural. In the second inaugural, he used only two personal pronouns. He once was meeting a group of folks in the White House, actually soldiers from Ohio, and he said to them, you know, this is such a wonderful country. Any of your children could one day become president of the United States just like my father's child has. Just like my father's child has. Why didn't he say, just like I have? Well, back to the beginning. The first selection is Lincoln's first announcement as a candidate for political office. He's barely 23 years of age. He has less than 1 year of formal education. The way you announced political office was to put a statement in the newspaper. It was a rather long statement, but here's the critical paragraph. Every man is said to have his peculiar ambition. Whether it be true or not, I can say for one that I have no other so great as that of being truly esteemed of my fellow men, by rendering myself worthy of their esteem. And then, being autobiographical, how far I shall succeed in gratifying this ambition is yet to be developed. I am young and unknown to many of you. I was born and have ever remained in the most humble walks of life. I have no wealthy or popular relations to recommend. Lincoln ran for office, and he was defeated. But in the region that people knew him best, right around New Salem, there were 307 votes cast. Abraham Lincoln received 270 of those votes. By the next time, 2 years from now, as his influence spread, he won election and another election and another election and another election until he voluntarily withdrew from the Illinois State Legislature. I wanted to trace Lincoln, the man, as his ambition, which sometimes needed to be pruned. This is a human Lincoln that I'm seeking to portray. His satire and humor could bite and hurt as a young man. He was opportunistic in many ways. He had to grow through the rough edges of young people as he mellowed and became the man that we would know as president. A central question that I think we ask today is, who wrote that speech? Did John F. Kennedy really say, "Ask not"? What about Barack Obama? Was that his speech that he delivered? I think mostly it was at the inauguration. Did Lincoln write his own speeches? Basically, he did, but with one exception, and I want to focus on that tonight. He came to Washington for his inauguration. He had been a great debater and a fine stump speaker, but I think he was nervous. So he showed his address to three people who from Illinois. Two of them said, "Great." The third made a very substantive suggestion on the draft that Lincoln gave him. We have that draft at the Huntington Library in San Marino. I've held it in my hand, where the man, the Illinois politician, Orville Browning, gave a suggestion to Lincoln. Then he arrived here in Washington, and his rival, William Seward, he had appointed Secretary of State. So after church at St. John's Episcopal on Lafayette Square on the first Sunday, he gave Seward a copy of his inaugural address, and he said, "If you will, would you take a look at this, and perhaps you'd like to make a few suggestions?" That evening, a knock on the door at parlor suite number 6 at the Willer Hotel, and there was Frederick Seward, William's son, handing an envelope to Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln must have been mightily surprised when he opened the envelope and found 7 pages of suggestions on how to improve his inaugural address. 49 suggestions. Seward had actually numbered every single line of the address in red. Well, Lincoln actually incorporated 22 of the 49 suggestions. But then when Lincoln got to the end of the letter, Seward said, "Forget your last paragraph. It will never do. Here I have written 2 new last paragraphs for you. Choose which one you will use." Lincoln chose one. And if you will turn the page, you will see that I have put that last paragraph in 2 columns. I like to say to students, there is no such thing as good writing. There's only good rewriting. And Lincoln was not some spontaneous genius who wrote everything out at first pen. Actually, he worked very hard at his writing. He revised and edited. I discovered through the process of living with him, I think day by day, that he always read out loud, and he usually wrote by whispering or speaking the word out loud to get the sound of the word before he put it on the paper. He said, "I read with 2 senses, the eye and the ear." So here is Seward and here is Lincoln. Seward, the first sentence, "I close." Lincoln, "I am loath to close." Well, what's going on here? We know, anybody here, I'm sure, that the way to edit is to cut those extraneous words, those extra adverbs, those extra adjectives. But Lincoln extends the sentence. "I want you to say the sentence out loud, and I think you'll hear what Lincoln is doing. Let's say it together, Lincoln's words, "I am loath to close." I tried to avoid technical words in my biography. This is actually called assonance. It's the taking of words of a similar sound and placing them right together. After the victories at Gettysburg and Vicksburg, the crowd came to the White House. They wanted a speech from Lincoln. He didn't like extemporaneous speeches, but he began his speech by saying, "What was it 80-some-odd years ago that our..." But 4 months later, 47 years ago, our forefathers... He had that sense of the rhyme, the cadence from the King James Bible. Give Lincoln time, and he could fashion words that we are still repeating today. The second sentence is the one that Barack Obama used on November 4, 2008. Seward wrote, "We are not, we must not be aliens or enemies, but fellow countrymen and brethren." Lincoln, "We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies." Short, strong, he had learned from the Psalms, which he memorized, that the way to state a truth is often to state it twice, in just a little bit different fashion. Well, the third sentence we'll skip, but the fourth one. Now you imagine that Lincoln is getting to the end of the envelope, end of the letter in the envelope, and he reads Seward's words. "The mystic chords which proceeding from so many battlefields and so many patriot graves pass through all the hearts and all the hearths in this broad continent of ours will yet again harmonize in their ancient music when breathed upon by the guardian angel of the nation." Lincoln must have thought, "Goodness me, what can I do with this sentence?" But watch what he does with it. This is the most memorable sentence from the first inaugural address. I want us to say it again, to hear the almost the musicality of the words of Lincoln. Let's say it slowly. I speak about 150, you do too, 160 words a minute. Lincoln spoke only 110 words a minute, purposely, very slowly. Let's say it. "The mystic chords of memory, testing from every battlefield and patriot grave to every heart and hearthstone all over this broad land will yet swell the chorus of the Union when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature." Another window in this biography is trying to engage the modern question, the question that has been asked in the last 25 years. What did Lincoln really think about slavery? Was he a racist? Does he deserve the title, the Great Emancipator? Well, when the Emancipation Proclamation was set forth on January 1, 1863, there was a provision in it for the arming of black troops, but Lincoln didn't really imagine that black soldiers could be fighting at the front. He knew that the soldiers of the Union Army were in many ways angry about the Emancipation Proclamation. They had signed on to save the Union, but not to free Negro slaves. Lincoln himself thought, along with most people, that perhaps slaves who had lived in kind of a passive life on plantations wouldn't have the ability or the courage to fight. So it wasn't Lincoln, but it was Stanton and some generals who began to suggest, perhaps out of military expediency, we need to have these men fighting. But then Lincoln watched what took place, and he became a champion. One of the modern critiques of Lincoln, again, is, well, he freed the slaves, but you don't hear him saying anything about who they are, their character, the qualities of their life. He doesn't seem to have any empathy for them. Well, at the end of the summer of 1863, he was invited to speak in Springfield, Massachusetts, at the largest Union rally of the war, 50,000 people. Oh, how he wanted to go. But he finally decided he couldn't take the time, so he sent a letter to be read. How do you speak to 50,000 people? There were 7 speaking stands erected on the fairgrounds in Springfield. He began his speech by saying, in a sense, "I know you don't agree with me. I know many of you are very unhappy with the Emancipation Proclamation." Lincoln sought to persuade those with whom he disagreed or disagreed with him. And then comes this marvelous paragraph, which was so prominent in Lincoln's day and has been so forgotten in our day. It says so much about Lincoln's real attitudes towards blacks and especially black soldiers. "Peace does not appear so distant as it did. I hope it will come soon and come to stay and so come as to be worth the keeping in all future time. It will then have been proved that among free men there can be no successful appeal from the ballot to the bullet." Oh, Lincoln loved alliteration. "And that they who take such an appeal are sure to lose their case and pay the cost." But this is the line. "And then there will be some black men who can remember that with silent tongue and clenched teeth and steady eye and well-poised bayonet, they have helped mankind on to this great consummation." Lincoln is praising the courage of these black soldiers. He might have stopped there, but he couldn't. He goes on to say something much more radical. "While I fear there will be some white ones, unable to forget that with malignant heart and deceitful speech, they have strove to hinder it." One final window. Lincoln has been viewed through almost all of time as a non-religious person. And yet people are perplexed. Well, how could a non-religious person deliver such a profound address as the second inaugural address, where in 701 words he mentions God 14 times, quotes the Bible 4 times, invokes prayer 3 times? I have been asked, or most often told, recently by a congressman who was formerly a professor of history, that Lincoln is, he's only simply doing what a cultured person would do in the middle of the 19th century, quote the Bible, quote Shakespeare, or else he's simply a shrewd politician who is simply using religion because this is a religious audience. That's a possible explanation, but it's not a good one. Lincoln defined himself by the little scraps of paper which he used. These were the way that he kept track of his own intellectual journey. There's more than 100 of them in the collected works of Lincoln. Because they've been separated and called fragments, we failed to notice, I think, the journey that he is on, which is a very real part of my biography. One of the most profound ones was written undated. I suggest here 1864. It was found after Lincoln's death, tucked in a drawer in the bottom of his desk. His young secretary, John Hay, found it, and in 1872 he gave it Hay's title, Meditation on the Divine Will. You judge whether you think Lincoln is struggling at a very deep level with profound religious questions. Lincoln writes, "For his eyes only, the will of God prevails. In great contests, each party claims to act in accordance with the will of God. Both may be and one must be wrong. God cannot be for and against the same thing at the same time." And then this profound sentence: "In the present civil war, it is quite possible that God's purpose is something different from the purpose of either party, and yet the human instrumentalities, working just as they do, are of the best adaptation to effect his purpose." One more sentence: "I'm almost ready to say this is probably true, that God wills this contest and wills that it shall not end yet." I suggest that Lincoln is on a profound religious journey, and that the missing person in the whole Lincoln story is his pastor at the New York Avenue Presbyterian Church, Phineas Densmore Gurley, number one in his class from Princeton Seminary. Lincoln was raised in a Baptist background that for him was far too emotional, far too anti-intellectual. He had to rebel against that. It didn't allow him to ask the questions he wanted, so he became a scoffer, a skeptic, not unusual for young people or young adults. But then he began to reappropriate elements of the Christian faith as an adult after the death of Willie and the death of all these soldiers, but it couldn't be the faith of his parents. He had to find a faith that was more rational and logical, but a faith that could also incorporate his sense of ambiguity. A central theme in my biography is that Lincoln is comfortable with ambiguity. Ambiguity has become a bad word in our time. Oh, you're a flip-flopper. Can't you make up your mind? In Lincoln's day, there were a lot of absolutists. On the left were the abolitionists, completely convinced of their cause. On the right were the secessionists. I think in our time, the voices on the right and the voices on the left are so loud that many of us who find ourselves in the moderate center often feel that our voices are muted. Let me read that last sentence a different way. I am almost ready to say this is probably true, that God wills this contest. In the second inaugural address, this is the foundation of the second inaugural address, Lincoln will say the Almighty has his own purposes. Do you hear the humility in that? Lincoln is affirming the fact that God is involved in history, but he's not in any arrogant way saying, and I know exactly how. I close with this. Why should we be interested in Abraham Lincoln in the 21st century? Lincoln, for a long part of his life, was a man of precedent as a lawyer, as a politician looking back to the Declaration of Independence. But a critical change occurred in him in the middle of the Civil War. I say he began to think in the future tense when everybody else was locked in the past. As Lincoln looks into the future, he offers these words, "The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate for the stormy present. As our case is new, so we must think anew and act anew." Lincoln had come to realize that every generation of Americans must redefine America in its own time. And the reason that Lincoln is important to us today is not that he can help us with climate change, not that he can tell us how to solve the problems of stem cell research, but that as Barack Obama has discovered, Lincoln can help us understand our own vocation, our own values, and help us be a model, if not a mentor, for redefining America in our time. Thank you very much.
Questions, if you'll line up at the mic.
Yes.
Thank you. That was absolutely delightful. I want to ask you about another great leader who shared many of the same qualities that you've described, in that both men held their countries together, Winston Churchill and Abraham Lincoln.
Yes.
Both were tremendous thinkers and orators, and both suffered from severe depression.
Yes.
Speak to us a little bit about Abraham Lincoln and his depression.
Lincoln did suffer from depression throughout his whole life. He also suffered from tremendous insecurities about his education. He always felt, in a sense, insecure. Someone in 1859 wrote the first history of the United States Congress, and they sent out a survey to each member of Congress to report back on who they were. And one of the questions was, tell us about your education. He must have thought of the people who had gone to Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and he wrote back one word, inadequate. Joshua Schenck, in his book, Lincoln's Melancholy, makes this suggestion, which I find persuasive, and that is that it's all the way we use the struggles within our life. We can turn inward or we can turn outward. Schenck suggests that this struggle, lifelong struggle with depression, may have very well made Lincoln more empathetic to others who were struggling with similar difficulties in their life. We wish we knew more about the exact elements of it. Lincoln never kept a diary, but I think this was a very real force in his life as he struggled with this depression. Yes.
With Reverend Gurley having accompanied Lincoln twice to Springfield on the death of his two children in the White House, can you comment further on what impact Gurley may have had on Lincoln's philosophy and overall belief?
Well, Lincoln attended the First Presbyterian Church in Springfield, another old school church. The difference between old and new school, they split in 1837, was the new school was into the revivalism of the Second Great Awakening and also into political action. They were strongly anti-slavery. The old school was anti-revivalism, meant anti-emotionalism, and believed the church should not speak on public issues. We have a number of Gurley's sermons, And I am now in the process, through a dear friend, I'm not sure if she's here tonight, but maybe she is, of transcribing these sermons. They're at the Presbyterian Historical Society in Philadelphia. We know of several sermons where Lincoln is present, and you can sense in these sermons the very language that Lincoln will then later use in the second inaugural address. Lincoln has been called a fatalist by the Lincoln biographers, as if somehow this is the same thing as determinism. I discovered a book in 1859 that calls fatalism a form of unbelief. Lincoln finds in Gurley and the old school Presbyterians a new way of speaking about the providential activity of God in history. I think he's a mentor.
The question I'd like to ask you, I've been involved in an argument, or trying to be an argument, with the Washington Post. On January 13th, they published something in the children's section about presidents, and they said about their religion. They said all presidents were Christians. And I've tried to take issue with that and saying it's not true with the first six presidents who were deists, but not Christians. And a belief in Christianity implies to me a belief in Jesus as a defined figure. And I don't think Lincoln believed that at all. So my question sort of is, without trying to be contentious, is it fair to say, Lincoln had a deep belief in God, but he was not a Christian?
I think it's hard to answer the question, quite honestly.
Did he ever use the word Jesus?
He did. This is the surprising thing. I've been told over and over and over again, he never used the word Jesus. That's simply not true. In fact, once in a wonderful circular that he as a young man, to the Whig Party, he was talking about what the polity of the Whig Party could be, and he said, it is just like the omniscience of God who sent his son to die upon the cross for our sins. This is Lincoln's words. I'm not trying to define Lincoln's faith. I'm trying to simply say that I don't think we know enough often to sort of say this is what he believed or didn't believe. He does speak of God much more than he does speak of Jesus, but he does speak of Jesus.
Frederick Douglass play any role in the evolution of Lincoln's thought on emancipation?
Wonderful question. Frederick Douglass is a very central person in this biography. From the very first time that Douglass listens and notices Lincoln debating Douglass, and that Douglass 29 times in the first two debates calls Lincoln a black Republican and 15 times calls him a nigger lover. And Douglass watches. When Lincoln offers the Emancipation Proclamation, Douglass is thrilled, and so he sets out on a 2,200-mile speaking tour to recruit blacks. But then he discovers that the blacks recruited are not being paid equally and not treated fairly. So he decides, under the urging of the general in charge of the recruitment, to go see Lincoln. He doesn't think he'll have much of a chance to see him, but in 5 minutes he's ushered into Lincoln's office. Lincoln stands up to greet him, and the following Sunday in Philadelphia, Douglass says, I have never been treated by a white man in this sense before. I know when prejudice is present. The next year, Lincoln calls Douglass in and says, the war isn't going too well. The key thing is to get African-American slaves into the Union lines. I can't do that, Douglass. You can. I'm asking you to use your organizational skills and the network of people who follow you to make this happen. After Lincoln's death, Mary Todd Lincoln sent Abraham Lincoln's cane to Frederick Douglass, and she said, I know my husband wanted you to have this because he viewed you as a dear friend. Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.